This is CliffCentral.com.
Adrian Groenewald, this is the Leadership Transformation Platform, empowering towards, or transforming towards, an empowered society. That's what we're trying to do. This first hour is our Leadership Masterclass, but the first half hour, we just had a conversation. You can get that podcast on the law of resistance, how we deal with challenges and problems in life. Now we're zooming in on a man who's gone through this in his personal leadership space, leading his own life, and of course his family following through this dramatic event in his life. And after the resistance comes the movement. So Joey Evans in the studio, dirt bike rider. That's how I say it, is it?
Yeah, it's good.
You're a biker.
There you go.
Yeah, you're a biker, but
part of the big biker family. Yeah.
Yeah, but mostly dirt biking.
Correct.
On the gravel roads and the sand roads. And your love for biking, that obviously started when you were young, like a BMX. Tell us about that. Where did all this start? Because I must tell you, as a parent, there's no way any of my kids will ever ask me for a motorbike. It's just a plain no. I'm sure your parents went through that as well.
I'm probably the same parent after my experience.
Yes.
But yeah, it started when I was young. You know, it started with bicycles. You know, I love bicycles. You know, I started on a little bike I got for Christmas once. It was a second-hand bike, and we used to ride that thing and make tracks all through the garden and things. And then I saved up money, and I got my first BMX bike, a little golden black rally racing. And man, that was my pride and joy. Then we started to get a bit bigger tracks. We moved over to the Veld, and where I grew up in Kempton Park, there were some old tennis courts where we had a place at the back where we'd build tracks and things, and you know, you'd mark with your foot dragging it through the sand how far you could jump on different jumps, and you'd beat your buddy's mark, and you know, it was all of that sort of stuff going up, and little ramps with wood and brick stacked up, the whole deal.
I remember your parents' garden and what we did in that garden. I want to go there.
Yeah, so don't have a goal for a beautiful garden if you have a son like you and friends like you have. And then how did you switch over into motorbike? I mean, that's the I'm sure there were moments you wished you never did it, but then in the end it's worked.
No,
for
you're
you.
True. I think the thing with biking, you know, or dirt biking or whatever kind of biking you do, it moves up a lot for, you know, in cost wise. Well, what bikes used to cost, I know it's a lot different now, but it was something I really wanted to do from when I was young. I had some mates in high school who did motocross, and I used to go watch them race, and it was like, man, I'd love to be out there racing and not standing here watching. But it took a long time until I could afford my own bike. You know, I grew up in a large family, and it wasn't going to happen as a kid. And so I actually only got my first bike when I was 25. You know, I bought
first motorbike
at 25, yeah. And I bought a second-hand motocross bike, and I started riding in the Veld and getting on it, and then I moved to motocross tracks and got into motocross, and you know, I rode motocross for a few years, and then I got into a bit of freestyle as well, you know, with the metal ramps and the tricks and that type of stuff. And then I moved over to hair scrambles and off-road and enduro, which is more like riding, you know, through mountains and rivers and that type of stuff. And that's really where I found my passion, you know. And then I started racing and competing, and that's kind of how
you get to the competition. So is that quite late for where you are today? When you go to the Dakar, starting at 25 is late.
It is late. You know, a lot of guys, especially the top riders, you know, they've peaked before they're 25 even, you know. So a lot of guys, you know, start off on little PBs at 7 or 8 years old and start racing like that, you know. The one fortunate thing starting at 25 is you skip all the breaking bones as teenagers part. So.
Yeah, I would think so. Hey, yeah. And you didn't, you have a different motorbike career, shall I say. It's not a teenager who gets on his motorbike and all ego and everything. For you, it was about rallying. It wasn't necessarily a transport mechanism or, you know, impressing the girls. Or for you, it was literally from a BMX bike or whatever.
I'd wheelie my BMX bike past the school, you know, to impress girls.
So won't lie. Yeah. That's the joke, I remember.
But it started, you know, with bicycles and BMXing and that type of stuff, and then it moved on to motorbikes. But to start motorbikes, you know, that late was, you know, at 25 or you know, 27 or whatever when I started actually racing. That's late, yeah.
That's quite late. All right, and then your competitions. How did you get into competitions? Well, when did you get married? What age?
Geez, you're carefully putting me on the spot here. 18th of July, 1998. They are past. I got married when I was 23.
Okay, so actually your wife went through this whole period of motorbiking and motocrossing, all that with you.
Yeah, it's fair to say she's been through a lot being married to me. But yes, that's correct, yeah.
Yep. All right, so when she married you, she didn't, well, she knew you'd somehow get into it, I guess. But
yeah. Just be careful here.
She's sitting here on the couch.
She's sitting here on the couch. She's watching you.
With us, right? Yeah. Well, no, I just, it's an interesting fact. I mean, she really went through all of this from the start.
Absolutely. She's seen the passion start, or she knew I had the passion when we first got married, but she saw the first bikes come into our family, I should say. And she's seen the whole process. She's seen the rise, the fall, and you know, all the challenges we've had, and you know, obviously having a husband who's been paralyzed, there's a whole heap load of challenges that came with that
we can't even imagine.
You know, they test your relationship as well, and she's been absolutely awesome. You know, Meredith has been just there every step of the way. She's seen the good, the bad, and the ugly, and all through, and supported me, sometimes standing next to me, rolling her eyes, but supporting me nonetheless.
Yeah. No, I mean, we could talk all day about that. I mean, the incredible support that you receive, and how challenging it can be from the other side of this whole equation. So when you started at 25, when did you get really more serious?
Fairly quickly, I guess. You know, I had some good bike skills in terms of bicycles, which then it's a brilliant crossover training for motorbikes, you know. And then got into it, and it's one of those things that I guess I'm a bit of the kind of guy that I get into it, and then I get into it all the time, and that's all I want to do, you know. It happens to guys who play squash or get running or ride mountain bikes. It's the same kind of thing. Suddenly your whole life revolves around it. And so got into a lot, started riding more with mates and things, and then you want to ride different places and more technical terrain and that type of stuff. And so then I moved on and started racing, and the racing, I just love that. You know, that just suited my personality down to the ground. You know, that was great. And
what part of your personality? Are you competitive, or is it just the technicality of it?
Competitive. You know, it's something that I'm a lot less so now, I guess. But back then, I look back and I think, man, I was crazy competitive. You know, it was ridiculous. You know, sometimes.
Dangerously, almost so. Yeah,
exactly. And also sometimes to the point of being a bit of a jerk sometimes, you know. And you kind of see that looking back. You know, I guess you often look back when you're older and think like, coulda, shoulda, woulda type thing, you know. I loved it. You know, it was competing obviously against yourself and the terrain, getting through the race. You know, when, you know, I did races like the desert race in Botswana, and I did a.
Just tell us how long was that?
1,000 kilometers.
1,000 kilometers, you know? Yeah, in Botswana. Yeah.
And then there was, you know, I did the Reef of Africa in 2006 and finished that one. And just to get a finisher's medal on those kind of races is fantastic, you know. I love to compete, and so that was great, and so I really enjoyed the racing. We'd go to as many races as we could, and that type of stuff.
Okay, when was the dream born of the Dakar Rally, which is the ultimate rally, is it?
It is.
Compare with in other sports? Just people who really don't know motocross. Gotcha. What does the Dakar Rally compare with?
Well, to give you an idea, the Dakar Rally is owned by ASO, which is the same company that owns the Tour de France, and so it would be really the Tour de France of motorbikes, okay. You know, be the best way to compare it. But the big difference is the Dakar Rally is one of these things where you can have the top guys, professionals racing it, as well as amateurs. And that's kind of the beauty of it, is that you get to be on such a massive stage as an amateur. You know, you have to reach certain, they have a selection process, and you have to send in a CV and kind of request an entry. They go through a selection process, and they select, you know, who they'll have on the start line type deal. So not anyone will get in, but if you work hard and you train hard and you spend a few years learning the skills, there's no reason why anyone couldn't do it.
Okay. So in the end, we'll talk about that towards the end, exactly what the Dakar means. I gave people a taste in the previous conversation. All right. Now, I think, I don't know, gentlemen here in the studio, should we get to that moment? You were at the start line of a race. Tell us what race.
Okay.
What age were you? Just give us a little bit more detail of what happened when you kicked off the race and you just woke up.
We want to
know what happened there.
All right. It was back in 2007, 13th of October 2007.
You were now how old? I mean,
32. Yeah, 32. Yeah. And I was at the start of the Heidelberg Hare Scramble. So Hare Scramble is an off-road race, but it's a fairly fast race. You normally do about 3 laps of 60 kilometers. You know, thereabouts, about 200 kilometers of racing, and very rocky terrain and felt and rivers and, you know, mountains, that type of stuff.
So it's a tough one. How long is it, do you say?
About 200 kilometers. Yeah.
So it takes you what, how long?
Is probably about three hours.
Okay, so it's a 3 hours type of race.
That type of thing. 3-4 hours, and it's the kind of thing that's considered a bit more of a sprint, as opposed to an endurance event. Mm. And we started what we call a mass start. They have various different ways of starting races, and a mass start is they line you all up in a line, and they drop a flag or something like that, and you just all go. And so it's always the start is probably the most dangerous and crazy part of the race.
Are there almost always people who fall or get hurt with a start, or not necessarily?
It can be, but it is often with a start, because if you pick. It's the only place in the race where you can make up 20 positions over a few hundred meters. You know, when you come into that first corner where it all bottlenecks, you want to be up top, And I'd done that race the previous year and had a terrible start. And so I was sitting on the race on the line thinking, man, I gotta make sure I get a good start here. So the engines are going and they dropped the flag and I just gave it all I had. But that's all I could remember, And then the next thing I know, I wake up and you got that lying on your back, staring at the sky with a bunch of heads around you, and you realize, uh-oh, something went really wrong here,
This is not how the race was supposed to be.
Yeah, that's it. Mm-hmm. So I joked a bit, realizing what had happened. I kind of said, hey, did I win? As a bit of a joke, and everyone kind of laughed, and someone was standing next to me, and my legs were leaning against her, it was Tiffany, my friend's wife, And as she moved away, my legs just fell down.
You could feel something
wasn't
right.
Something wasn't right. It was just dead meat. It's an incredible feeling. There's just nothing there. You're looking at the stuff that you can't move, you can't feel. It was like a big chunk of dead meat. And it just fell to the side. And my wife was there as well. They'd all run up to me. I was just a couple hundred meters into the race. And so they were all there. And when I woke up, I pulled the paramedic close to me and I said, hey man, I can't feel my legs, but I didn't want my wife to hear and things because I knew it would be scary. And then it was like, whoa. Then they realized this was a whole nother scale, and I'd broken 12 teeth as well. And so I thought I had all dirt in my mouth, but it was my
rocks
my
in your
teeth,
mouth.
That I was spitting out and things. And then it was trying to get helicopters and all that sort of stuff. And there was a lot of problems that day with that. And so eventually they had to get an ambulance out and transport me by road. But I lay in the dirt there for about 3 hours before I was, evacuated and taken to hospital. With spinal cord injuries, that time means a lot, and how you're treated, your body after you've had the injury, in terms of trying to keep your spine, still as possible and that type of stuff.
You would think that they're kind of geared for that sort of possibility at a big race?
They are, and it's got better and better over the years for sure, the Dakar is a perfect example. They say they'll have a chopper with an actual doctor, on your location quicker than they can have someone on your location if you have a car accident in Paris. In terms of medical, it's incredible, what they do. And the local South African race series, is leaps and bounds ahead of, where perhaps it used to be,
All right. So that's dramatic. You end up in hospital. When does the actual moment break when they say, sorry, you're paralyzed. You probably will never race again.
Well, it wasn't race again that was the thing. It was walk again, live again type deal. And so I went to, a few different hospitals. I was transferred to a couple different ones, and I ended up at the MealMed unit in Pretoria. But the first couple guys that saw me said, look, this is a complete spinal cord injury. The bottom line is you're paralyzed, and that's the deal. It's something you're going to have to come to terms with. They were pretty straight up about it, which is, I guess, the way I'd appreciate it on that kind of guy. And so it was, all right, we're not going to walk again. It's the rest of your life in a wheelchair. And that's the deal. And the third guy, the third doctor we were with in Pretoria, as it went on, he said, look, the previous guy said, let's not operate, let's just leave it, let swelling go down, that type of stuff. And he said, look, he thinks we should fuse the back, take pressure off the spinal cord and go for it from there, And it was, man, it was scary. What do we do? Do we do this fusion? Do we not, And it was a lot of back and forth. And I just felt, man, let's just do this, let's give myself the best possible chance. And so we did that. But it was a case of you kind of trying to come to terms with it, but it's like the person you are in your mind and the body you're living in were two different people. You don't relate to the two. When you fall asleep at night, you dream, you're running and you're riding bikes and you're playing with your kids, and that's how you dream. And you wake up and you look at this body and you're like, I'm not that person. And it's, and it, you go through this kind of torn,
two different realities.
Yeah,
almost, eh?
this kind of torn person that's two different people. You know, who you, your physical person and the person you are on the inside.
So, so, Joey, the fusion concept, wasn't that automatic deduction that it'll limit you in the future?
No, with my T vertebrae, they're the ones that the ribs are connected to, you know. So it was just fusing a couple of vertebrae. So it wasn't fusing the whole back and things. So it wouldn't restrict. They gave me a, they gave me a stat at the time. It was like 2% in terms of turning ability and that or something like that, you know. So it was very little from a restriction point of view. It was more a case of let's get the bones right, you know. Obviously, the nerve damage was the big one, but it's like let's get the bones right and take any kind of pressure off the nerves, if that makes sense.
Okay, just share with us what it was like when you were on your own in that hospital room, no family, no one there, kind of knowing, of course you had a different hope, that this is how your life has changed. I mean, when you were at your weakest, most vulnerable, what was it like?
Okay, you're trying to make me cry, but I'm not going to. I actually had tremendous support. So I had people around me a lot of the time, you know, lots of friends, lots of family.
That helps.
Know, massive. Mm. I can't even explain the difference it makes to have support, you know. And so in terms of if you ever know anyone who goes through something like a support is everything, you know. Mm. But yeah, there was absolutely those times where you'd lie there in bed at night alone or whatever. And I think it just, everything kind of hits you, man. And you're like, this is crazy. I can't do this. There's no ways, you know. And it was some really tough, dark times. Some real lows, you know, definitely some real lows, you know. But what
swung it? At what moment did you decide? Was it a moment? Was it a process where you said, okay, this is it. I'm not going to let this beat me. I'm going to fight it, you know. Was that clear for you, or was it a very slow process, just happened over time, or was it a real clear thing?
Yeah, a bit of both. You know, I'm generally quite positive, and so I was like, I'm going to do this. And I told my wife, don't stress, we're going to be fine. I got this. You know, we can handle this. We're going to do this.
Did you believe that statement from the beginning, or was that for a while it was just...
No, for a while it was like, be that person, but on the inside you're thinking, how am I going to do this, you know, because it really is a, you know, something that's changed. There was a big turning point for me, and the big turning point was I was getting fitted for a wheelchair, because obviously wheelchairs get changed according to, you know, how big you are and your abilities and that kind of stuff. And so I was at CE Mobility getting fitted for a wheelchair, having measurements and all that sort of stuff, and I met another guy there. Who just by chance was also he was paralyzed, and he had limited movement, you know. So he was also the same as me, which is what we call an incomplete spinal cord injury, and he was there, and he was getting fitted for his second or third wheelchair, you know, a few years along, and we chatted a bit, and he was like, oh, where are you from? And I said, no, where are you being treated? And I was at Milmed in Pretoria, and he was like, oh, it was the same, you know, I was also there and stuff, and I was like, oh, no ways, and we chatted, and it turned out we had the same. Physiotherapist and occupational therapist at, you know, and things. And so we chatted a while and stuff, and it was great, you know. I got fitted for my wheelchair and things, and I went back you know, to the hospital for more treatment and things, and I said to my physiotherapist, I said, I met, I can't even remember his name, to be honest, but I met this guy, and he said he was shooting. She's like, oh, that's excellent, you know. And she said, how's he walking? And I said, no, he was getting fitted for a wheelchair. And she's like, no, he was one of those guys that could have walked if he put in the effort and stuff. And when I spoke to the guy there, he said, yes, he can walk a bit, you know, but he says it's just really difficult and very slow, and so it's much easier just to move around the wheelchair it makes. And I was like, no ways am I going to be that guy, you know. I was like, there is no way. So I didn't know how far I could go. I didn't know if I'd ever walk again. I didn't know what the goalposts were. I don't know what was physically possible, because obviously you have a lot of physical things that there's nothing you can do about it physically. But I thought, I'm certainly going to give this everything I got. There's no ways anyone will ever say that he didn't try hard enough.
That's a very interesting personal motivation there. Did the dream of Dakar ever play a role, or at that time it was just almost your personality, your character saying, I will not be remembered as a guy by my family or anyone else for having given up, for not trying hard enough? Do you remember?
Yeah, I do.
Do you just think you had a bigger dream than this guy? Why could Joey, you know, in the end, make him this guy not? Maybe it's a character thing. Maybe it's a dream. Like people in the concentration camps who you know, Viktor Frankl type stuff, where they had to dream about their family and all the other things that got them through it.
Yeah, there was obviously lots of different things, you know, but there was a lot of motivation for me. I was going to beat this thing from the start. I was like, there is no way I'm going to beat this, you know. And sometimes you beat serious injuries like paralysis by walking again, and sometimes you beat it by your mind not being held back by your body, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
so sometimes you can't.
It's attitudinal thing.
That's it. It's there is physical though. Some guys, I've met many guys who have complete injuries, and they don't walk again, but they haven't let it change them, and they've beaten it, even though they're not walking, if that makes sense. For me, the Dakar thing was there. You know, I wanted to do the Dakar before my injury, and so it was one of those things where I laid in the hospital bed and I thought, how awesome would it be to come from here and to race the Dakar one day? And I was like, man, that would be a comeback, you know. And so it did help with my motivation. I was like, that would be great. At the time, there was no ways I thought it was possible, you know. It was certainly something I wanted to do, but it was like, just to be able to stand would be fantastic. Just to be able to walk, you know, would be fantastic. So it was way too far in the distance.
Okay, so before you, Alice and Louis and Richard, any of you, just come in for a moment, maybe have a question or two, feelings, thoughts. And after that, I just want you to tell us, I know somewhere in a write-up you gave me, you said you had no idea what lay ahead.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I want you to tell us what lay ahead.
Okay.
Because now it's hindsight. But before we get there, and then we end off with where you're heading from here. Alice, Richard, any comments, thoughts, feelings? I mean, Richard, you grew up with him. Alice, you kind of know him as well. Any comments?
I know Joey from the other side. I know that he's a very spiritual man. So what I wanted to find out from Joe, how much of that did that play a part in what I would call the power of decision? You know, when that wheelchair came and there was a view that he'll be fitted for it, he decided that it just wasn't going to be for him. So can you walk us through that, Joey, in terms of just your spiritual side of things? How did it help you?
For sure. Yeah, you kind of, when you're lying there, you realize that there's a lot of powers that are a lot stronger than you are. And you're kind of in a situation where you're like, man, I can't do this alone. I'm going to need help here. I'm going to need a lot of help. And so there was a lot of calling for extra help. And knowing that you've got friends and family and, you know, friends overseas and all sorts of people praying and, you know, thinking about you and stuff makes a world of difference. But at the same time, you know, you got to give everything you got. And then, you know, you got your Heavenly Father there to play top up, you know. And so there was certainly a feeling of like, I'm not alone in this and we got this.
So this strengthened not only your physical resilience, your determination, your goal setting, your all of that, but it strengthened your faith.
Absolutely, yeah.
Your belief that, you know, the power of on high, prayer, friends, you know, the faith of lots of people, all of that played a role then.
Yeah.
So Joe is a walking miracle. Is that fair?
With a lot of effort on top. Yeah. All of the elements coming together.
Absolutely.
Richard?
I mean, if I look at your experiences, I mean, what if I was to say to you, what is the one thing that you've taken away from this experience? One thing that kind of, if you were to share this with somebody out there, what is that one thing that you say, this is my learning in the last 10 years?
Don't crash motorbikes.
Don't crash.
That's an obvious one.
No, I think the one thing that I didn't realize, you know, before this was that nobody knows the outcome. Don't let anybody tell you the outcome. They don't know the outcome. They can tell you that the cancer you've got, you're going to die from. They can tell you that nobody coming from your background will ever achieve those kind of business things or education things. And they don't know that. They're telling you what they've experienced in their life, but they don't know. You can't tell someone now who has a complete spinal cord injury that they'll never walk again. You don't know that. You know.
That's a powerful message.
That's a very
no
powerful.
One knows the outcome. Don't let any... I almost said idiot.
go with that.
Don't let any person come to you and say,
that's a critical thing.
You can't or you won't. Or you can listen. And often it's those who love you most. Often it's your parents, your family, your friends, who actually are looking out for you.
Yeah.
And they really believe you're going to hurt yourself, or you're going to overdo it, or overextend yourself, or whatever it may be. But the point is, people often give you advice as though they know the flipping outcome, but they don't.
Exactly that. Yeah. You know, you've got to have that. If you think you can do it, and or even if you want to think you can do it, you go with that, and that'll climb, and that'll climb, and suddenly, you know, I'm sitting here 10 years later, and I'm walking, you know, I can't run properly, I can do a bit of a funny job, but I'm standing here on the edge of achieving, you know, my dream, and if someone told me, you know, if anyone looked at me 10 years ago, there is no way they would ever see me here, you know, and so it's and it goes the same for, we've seen it with so many leaders in our country and all over the world that have just overcome incredible odds, way more than what I've had to deal with. And so, you know, look at your own lives and say, like, no one tells me how this finishes. I decide how the story finishes.
I think, though, Adrian, Joey, we must just differentiate between the physical consequences and the emotional and spiritual ones. You say you knew people in wheelchairs who never got to walking, but they overcome themselves.
Yes.
So ultimately, that is the central lesson. Don't always look for physical manifestations.
Yes.
That often follows that positive attitude. But really, it's a case of overcoming yourself. And these people are a great asset to the world, probably. You know? And they might not be walking.
And I also think the fundamental lesson for leaders out of what Joey is saying is that as a leader, you have to accept that you don't know the whole script.
Yeah.
But leaders fall into this trap that because of the title that you hold, therefore you can prescribe what needs to happen.
Mm.
Often you get blindsided. I mean, that's how we've ended up with the most major crisis in the world, because leaders got blindsided like everyone else.
Mm. Very good points there. Okay, just quickly, Joey, a very quick rundown. What lay ahead? I mean, you were saying you had that
from after the accident going forward.
After the accident, you were with this guy. You said, no one's going to ever blame me or accuse me of not trying my best. You thought of the Dakar. It would be great to achieve that dream from here, this low base. But then what actually lay ahead, it wasn't easy.
I think the biggest thing in the beginning was that every dream you had, every goal you had, now goes away and it all changes. You're not that person anymore. You know, I loved sports. You know, prior to my accident, you know, I loved running for a long time. I did you know, a few marathons and ultra marathons and things like that. And I you know, played lots of different sports, and I loved all that type of stuff. And suddenly all that's gone. All that soccer you practiced is gone. You know, all those running you've done is gone. Everything's gone. And all those dreams you had of doing these different things, it's all gone. And so now you're trying to think, like, well, what from here? And you suddenly, all your dreams are gone. Everything's gone. And you're worried about just getting through today. Obviously, with the physical problems as well, you know, once I came out of the hospital, I got all ramps put up in my house. You know, my brother, my brother-in-law put up ramps in my house so to get me around with a wheelchair and things. And as part of spinal cord injuries, you lose all bowel and bladder control and these kind of things, which is stuff other people don't see, but it's really tough to deal with, you know. And so, you know, you're dealing with all of those type of things. And so it was really tough. You're thinking, you know, I'm a father and I have four daughters, which I had at the time. And so you're thinking, man, how am I going to be a dad? You know, like this, how do I do this? How do I play with my kids? How do I go to the beach? How's things going to happen? You know? And so all of a sudden, all of these dreams are gone. How am I going to earn money? You know? And so each day was, I guess, a battle every day, you know? And I was determined to be positive. You know, myself and my wife, we spoke about it, about not changing your personality, not being short-tempered or frustrated or, you know, and so we would try to, like, continually be positive, positive, positive all the time. And I'd like to say I was always positive and things were great and I was always motivated. I was this guy who was, you know, the physiotherapist said 10 and I did 12, you know, so, and often I was that guy, but I wasn't always that guy, you know. There were some days where it just all kind of hit you and you were like, you couldn't do this, but the next day you get up and you do it again and you try harder. And so there was a lot of physical challenges in terms of the house, in terms of getting around, in terms of driving, in terms of running your business, in terms of interacting with your children, and you know, there was a lot, and it was something that's been a process. There's still a lot of physical problems that I still deal with now. And here we are sitting at, you know, nearly 9 years on. And so each little victory, you kind of celebrate that little victory. The first time you get your toe that flickers, and the first time you get a bit of movement in your ankle, and you know, that kind of stuff. And so as we went along, we had all of this little things that kind of gave you hope. And what I was often reminded of, which Meredith was very good at doing, as well as other friends and stuff, they would say, yeah, but remember 6 months ago you couldn't do that, or remember 2 weeks ago you couldn't do that.
The context.
And then you're like, yeah. And you look at what you go from that bottom base, and you look at what you've achieved coming out of that bottom base. You don't look who you were before that bottom base. You know, you start at the bottom now, and then you start notching those things up, you know. And so that
wonderful
that
insight
really made the difference.
You had a setback very quickly somewhere last year. I don't know when you had
a couple of years ago. Yeah.
What happened?
Well, I was working towards my Dakar goal. You know, I was riding a lot, racing again.
Getting
that
momentum.
Kind of stuff. Getting momentum. And I'm like thinking, man, I can do this. I can do this. And we're moving along, and I was out near the Swaziland border doing the Pongola 500. And I hit a cow. And I hit a cow at about 100 k's an hour.
How fast?
About 100 kilometers an hour. Yeah, it was on dirt, you know.
Stationary car.
Yep, very stationary. And I went off there, and that was terrible. I mean, I tore all my triceps and broke my elbow and separated my collarbone and broke ribs and deep lacerations down to the bone. And it was tough, man. You know, after what I'd been through, I was like, and here we go again, you know.
A lot of it the same again.
Yeah, well, it was easy compared to the back thing, you know, because spinal cord injuries is on a whole other level.
But on top of that, it can be almost more difficult, perhaps, in some cases.
Yeah, going back to the hospital, you got that sick feeling in your stomach being in hospital again, you know, being operated on again. It's all like, man. And obviously, you get a lot of heat from people thinking, well, what are you doing riding again? You know, what are you thinking? I'm sure... You know, some of the listeners out there are thinking the same thing. Yeah. But it was something that gives me so much, you know. And so that kind of put all the plans back again. And I thought about it, and I thought, no, I'm not going to let this stop me now. You know, this is...
Not a cow.
Not a cow, come on. And I looked out a lot for camels in Morocco, and I'll tell you that much. But it was like, no, we're gonna do this, and it was tough. It was tough healing. It was tough doing it, but we did what we had to do. It was a couple of operations, and then we got on it again, and we got back to it again. And I went back and did that same race, you know, the following year, and finished it. Finished it great, and so it was incredible to do that. You know, to be back there again and ride the same tracks and get through it.
Look
so
out
it was,
for the same car.
Yeah, we ride a lot slower.
So we're at the end here, but let's take 3 minutes or so. Just now, you've done. When you say you've now qualified for the Dakar,
yeah.
So they've looked at your screened you.
Yeah.
Your CV as such, they've looked at you, you did the Morocco. Did they say you just needed to do one more race, the Morocco?
The way it works is obviously they have like a screening where they have a look. But what they've done this year is they've said, right, with this rally, you need to, with the Morocco rally, the way it works is that you have to finish the pro class. So you get different classes, and the pro class is like the top class.
Okay.
And what you need to do is just finish the pro class, and they would consider that enough to qualify for the rally. Obviously, being a very difficult race in terms of terrain, in terms of navigation, you know, that kind of stuff. So I went and did the Morocco rally, which was incredibly tough, but I got that finish that I needed. And so that guarantees me an entry.
We could talk to you just about that rally. I mean, 7 days, Morocco. And when you say incredibly tough, we get the message.
Yeah.
Now, here you sit. In January, it's the Dakar race, 14 days. It's a hell of a financial burden. You have your own business, so you're running your own business on the side.
That's it, yeah. Very much on the side at times, yeah.
Yeah, and you told me it's about R1 million just to get to the starting blocks.
Yeah.
And then hundreds of thousands of rands for the whole race, and it's teams, and it's it's mind-blowing what you now need to do. Just tell us about that for a moment, what now lies ahead.
Sure, yeah. Well, you know, it's like you were saying, it's about R1 million to get on that start line. But obviously, it takes years of riding bikes and years of learning and racing and stuff. So you don't even take that into consideration, you know. But right now, here I am, you know, 7 months to go, and I'm not about to let a little thing like money stand in the way at this stage. So that's what we're going for. So yeah, there's going to be a lot of, you know, different fundraising things. You know, I've got my website, you know, I'm going to be doing different things to work my way towards there. But we're doing it one way or another. You know, it's going to happen in January. And so yeah, it's just another challenge, you know, on the way to this dream.
What does it mean for you if you get it? I mean, will you then have more opportunities in your life? Is this just a dream you want to achieve? Because it's not like some other spectator sports. We all know about Dakar somewhere. You know, yeah. We all know it's a big thing.
Yeah.
But it's sometimes like, I don't know if it's like squash or there's some incredible sports which don't necessarily have a professional career. You know, where you can really earn a great living out of it. You
yeah. So it's a little different to squash, but it's not really, you know, it's not really the purpose is to open up a lot of doors and that kind of stuff. It's really kind of like a big goal, you know, for me. Perhaps for cyclists it would be to go to the Tour de France or to do the Epic or something like that. But it's really once I get back, it's a case of, all right, let's try to recover, you know, financially and otherwise, and you know, carry on with life. But it's certainly something that's been, you know, that's kind of the big prize that we're going for.
Okay, your website, just give us some detail. There might be one super wealthy millionaire who loves
one of those guys biking. Richard was talking about playing golf and board now. My website is from Para to Dakar, you know, Para, P-A-R-A. And that's, you know, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a setup where anyone who wants to donate towards it on a personal setup, you can click on a button there and you can make a donation, and then I'll put your name on my bike. So I hope to have a bike that's full of, you know, hundreds of different names of people that are, you know, people who have known me before, or people that met me now and who believe in the dream and want to be part of it. So their name will be on a bike racing in Dakar.
Is there any advantage for a big corporate?
Absolutely, yeah.
There would be exposure and opportunity, yeah?
For sure. I mean, it's one of the most...
We'll be covered. You know, the whole event will be covered somehow.
Massive. I mean, the coverage we have here in South Africa is we have about a half an hour program every night for 2 weeks, showing various times during the day. But worldwide, it's the biggest watch event worldwide, bigger than Formula One, anything like that. So it's a massive, massive following.
All right.
So yeah, there's a lot of opportunities for especially companies that are worldwide, and we would put you know, branding on the bike for that as well.
Quick question for Joey, just on this point: has there been any other South Africans that have participated in this?
Yeah, there has. Over the years, as far as bike riders go, I don't know the exact number, but there's around about 9 or 10 guys that have finished the Dakar the last, you know, 30 odd years.
But more than those that have actually participated. It's about finishing, isn't it?
Yeah, that's finishing. Now, there's been plenty of guys that have participated that haven't finished, but there's been 10 that have finished. The finishing rate is about 40%, to give you an idea.
Wow.
And this is all through the desert?
Desert, mountains, forest, terrain, all sorts. This year, it goes through Paraguay, Bolivia, and Argentina. So three different countries, three very different countries. You know, we've got Bolivia, which is over, you know, a lot of it's over 4,000 meters, the race.
Okay, so... Wow, rather you than me, but man, what a fantastic story. We've got to end it for the whole panel here. You know, this is what I kind of dislike about South Africa. You find a guy like this, especially if he finishes it, but even before.
He will finish it.
Yeah,
when I finish.
When he finishes it, but what I'm saying, it will make sense. In America, where you have such a big country, you know, you'd go on speaking tours. You'd make a living out of your story.
300 million people.
In South Africa, it's just like, you know, we're just so small-minded. We don't get on top of these kind of situations with these sort of.
But we'll transform that. That's what this platform is about.
Let's change it. So Joey Evans, well done, and Dakar to.
From Para to Dakar. There we go. Not the other way around, please.
No, been there, done that.
All right. So we wish you well. We'll obviously, we've got enough people who live close by to you, friends and family, and so on. And we'll stay on top of this. We wish you well.
Thank you.
We'll wish you into winning. In the end, you can't say you did it. You'll have to say we did it.
And all those names on the bike, that's for sure.
All those names on the bike. And hope we can get a big corporate sponsor. Let's see what happens. But we wish you well. Thank you for the lessons we've learned in the first half hour and this half hour about the law of resistance. And what I like, I'll always remember, is your question, Richard, to him. You said, no one knows the outcome.
exactly that.
Don't let anyone tell you what the outcome is. They don't know. No one can see a minute into the future. All right, next up is our Business Master Class. Let me quickly share an Sibanye inspirational leadership thought at the end of this. As the executive inspirational thought, you've got to listen to this one. It had new meaning for me. It says, life's challenges are not supposed to paralyze you. They're supposed to help you discover who you are. media web apps. I don't know whose quote that is, but I mean, I just thought it had a different meaning in your life. Stay with us, Business Masterclass, for the next hour, and we moved a little bit into that show, but worth it. We're going to talk with Hugh Crankshaw of Cornerstone Wealth Management, and about something very important that we miss so easily, keyman insurance, all kinds of insurance you need in your business that are really crucial. But of course, we have a live panel, a couple of SME owners in the studio who can ask any questions of the panel at any time, but they pitch their business for 30 seconds. Stay with us.
This is CliffCentral.com.